on the banks of the Grand River, high above the Alora Gorge. This is the Buzzer Podcast. Indie music, new releases, industry insiders, out-of-the-box conversations with guests from the true north, from the west coast to the east coast to across the pond, and from down under. And now, here is Shay.
Hey, Shay here on Air Indie. Welcome and enjoy episode 33, first music history boil down for April the 5th. In 1985, at 3:50 p.m. GMT time, about 5,000 radio stations around the globe simultaneously played We Are the World. And in 1994, Kurt Cobain, at age 27, committed suicide. Rest in peace. This episode, soulful folk singer Colby Knickerbocker joins us from Bend, Oregon, United States. We feature several tracks from his album, Over and Over, released in April of this year. So hi, Colby. Today we have Colby Knickerbocker on our show. How are you doing, Colby?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on the podcast. The new album, EP you put out is outstanding.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind words.
This isn't the first EP you put out. You started in 2004 with Kitty's Music Box.
I did.
And for multiple other albums after that, yeah. To be involved in 2004, that's quite a long time in music.
It's a long time. And, you know, my music started when I was very young, you know, just finding this natural sort of attraction to music and being able to hear things, feel rhythms, feel like chord changes coming on as just a very, like, you know, 5-6 year old, just really having this intuitive feeling and gift toward music. And from then picking up a guitar and wanting to hear, you probably remember back in the day, we didn't have Spotify or CDs were just coming out. So if you wanted to hear a song, you had to listen to the radio. So instead of listening at late night to the show that I thought would play the song and having like the, you know, play record button on my tape cassette ready to go, I in a way hacked the system and it's like, I'm going to learn how to play this song on the guitar so I can just hear it whenever I want to hear it. And so this was like, that was sort of my introduction to music and my inclination to music. And then, yeah, 2004, I'd been playing music just as a hobby, really as a pastime, as a hobby, as like a cheap form of therapy, and adolescence. And then 2004, I was in college, met another really great songwriter, and we started a band called Kitty's Music Box. And I regret the name now, but back in the day, it was like, this is what we were going to do. So that was like my first real introduction to like recording, production, mixing, anything, right? It was just like me and my friend had these songs, mm-hmm. and we wanted to record them. And I had a little Windows PC and I had what was then, it was eMagic's Logic, right? It's Apple since bought eMagic and you know, Logic is like one of the most popular DAW softwares. But back then it was eMagic. And so it was just like, we recorded everything down. I think I only mixed everything to levels. Like I didn't EQ anything. And it was just like production. I've listened to the mix now. It's like, oh my gosh, there's so much improvement. But that's where we were back in the day. And my learning process. So that's Kitty's Music Box. And then I started, another project with Rodell's Machine, another great songwriter. I started a project, Rodell's Machine, with another great songwriter, Nate Donis. And that was when I sort of, decided to really take music seriously. I was right after I just graduated college as the market, like the 2008 crash was happening. So it was like I graduated, then the crash happened like within the month and no one was hiring to do anything. Like it was just like this frenzy of panic. And so I couldn't.
What were you trained in college?
Oh my gosh. I have a master's in economic history from the London School of Economics. So I'm like way out over here mentally, college week. And then I've got like music. So I've got this diverse background for better and for worse. So I came out of this, you know, with this great education, which is fantastic. I don't regret it at all. And I couldn't find a job. So I was like, whatever. I was energetic and arrogant. So I was like, I'll just do music. Like, I'm good at music, so I'll do that. And me and Nate recorded a few albums, a couple EPs, and we did the music thing for 7 years now. 7 years we played shows almost every weekend, played farmers markets, restaurants, just anything we can get our hands on. And I was doing like recording engineering on the side and helping other bands produce. And it was just like the hustle of the full-time music career. And that was great. I mean, we were on stage all the time, and you know, we were getting fans and playing shows and touring around colleges, and it was great. And after like 7 years, I know our music was good and it still has legs and it still creates traction today. I think it didn't find its audience quick enough for our energy to sustain that level of dedication, right? Playing all the time and just sort of hustling. So after like 7 years, we're both like, okay, let's pare it back a little bit. I got a jobby job, as I call it, like a 9-to-5 job. And then I started my solo career, solo music, you know, production with the first EP and then this latest EP. And that's been really good. And both of, you know, every, you know, even the previous works that we've done, with Roselle's Machine and my solo EP, they've been doing really well. Just like we every week get new fans just from people hearing it, which is kind of cool. It sort of shows like, that's kind of point to the first, point I made is like our first music project didn't find its audience quick enough because I see the audience coming. I was like, where have you guys been? And at the same time to like everyone who replies, like, where have you been? I've never heard your music. And I go, yeah, where were you in 2010 when we were like hustling to get fans? But that's just the nature of music business. Sometimes your music finds an audience right away and you rock it to the top. And sometimes it takes time. But that's in a nutshell, sort of the.
So the work that you did with Nate Donis was you did two EPs, Rodello's Machine in 2001 and Animus in 2016.
That's right. Yeah.
And then you toured with him on that.
I toured with him, and there was an album in there called Red Dust. I forget the release date of that.
Yeah, in 2015.
Yeah, 2015.
And was that with him or was that with solo?
No, that was with him as well. Yeah, that was. That was with him, and we toured with those songs, and we had so much fun. I mean, it was the most fun I think I've ever had in music. And I'm realizing that now, that the fun was in being with another musician intimately writing songs, but also we had like a band that we would call up, and it's just so much fun as a musician to get in a room with a couple other musicians who are equally as talented in different fields, and it's just like playtime. Like, I remember when we were recording Red Dust, we hired out a studio, and it was just like for a week and a half, we were in the studio, and I was like, I didn't know time was passing. Cause it was just like, it was so much fun just creating and laying down tracks. And that was the most fun I've had. So that's when I toured with Nate. And we had a great time during those EPs and that album.
Mm-hmm. Well, collaborations bring out the best in an artist. I've said that a million times. And 2019, your solo project, Kindness Courage. How was that different then when you decided to go solo?
Yeah, it was, you know, I think the decision to do that was out of, you know, it was a couple of things. Like I had a jobby job, so I didn't have as much time to collaborate and with another artist. And I had these other songs in the back of my head, and I wanted to just sort of try as a solo song. Cause I had these projects, Kitty's Music Box, Rodell's Machine. I was always like the producer, backup vocals, you know, I was always like just behind the front man. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, let me see if I've got the chops to be the front songwriter, to like, to have all of my ideas up front. And that's kind of what spawned the idea of, you know, to do like Kindness Courage. And I had all the chops as the, you know, the producer, the recording engineer in my home studio. So I had all that behind me, and it was me wanting to see how it worked. And I recorded it, and I was super nervous, but I think the, I don't know if you would call it luck of the first strike, or, you know, beginner's luck, or like the universe saying like, keep going, is like, I released the first track, Kindness Courage. Got some good critical review, and then I released the second track, Promise, and it got immediately on a Spotify algorithmic editorial playlist, which Now I look back and I was like, that was huge. But back in the day, I was like, oh yeah, of course it is, because it's a great song. And that's how, you know, that's how it's going to be for the rest of it. But that's been the only editorial playlist. But that like rocketed, you know, my music to everyone, like millions of fans. So that was great. And then, you know, from that, there, I had a lot of TV and film placements from that EP. So there's been this, a lot of this just motivation on the back end for my music, and demand from different producers, creators, sync agents, and listeners say like, yeah, it's good. So I kind of got this affirmation of like, yeah, I am good enough as a songwriter to be the front man.
You definitely are.
Thank you. Yeah.
I love you, Reese.
I appreciate the kind words. And I was just chatting with another songwriter yesterday actually about this. And I was like, hey, I miss having a partner or a team, because I think as a solo artist, as a solo indie artist, I should say, it relies so much on my shoulders to like the everything, the marketing, the recording, the production, the songwriting, the finance, the connections, the PR. It's all on my shoulders, and it can be really tiring after a while. And so I'm like, mm-hmm. I could use like, just even if it's just me like hiring a producer, like I could use like a producer on my next album, or like a studio engineer, so I can at least offload that. And like, so I'm thinking I'm thinking about this, you know, another album coming out, I'm like, there's definitely gonna be a team with me, just so I can have a little more fun, you know, have a little more fun is my goal for the next songwriting project.
Well, inviting a producer makes a whole lot of sense, because it gives you a second set of ears, a second set of eyes.
Yeah.
It can completely remake a song.
Absolutely. And I'm finding a lot of value in that. I mean, it's a perfect segue. And so I think to the first track we're going to share is that Over and Over, the alternate mix I worked with a fabulous producer, David Jacob Strain. He's an Americana songwriter, amazing songwriter, an amazing producer. And I've worked with him on a few other tracks, but he was able to your point, he having that second set of ears, he was able to really hear what I was doing and go, it's all good. And I really like these three aspects of what you're doing. I really feel like the soul of the song is in those three aspects. I'm going to pull those aspects out, and I'm going to emphasize those through some different instrumentation. And so what he did, I'm like, oh my God, like that's amazing. Like I was so excited and happy and pleased with what he did, because as the role of a producer, he can, that second set of ears can really hear what you're trying to do and go, okay, I see your direction, but I think if we turn those down and turn these two up, it's going to get your direction a lot clearer. So there's so much value in that for sure.
Well, I definitely I love both versions, but I definitely love the alternative version.
Thank you.
But it is a dedication of love for your wife, like the song Promise that won critical acclaim as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's funny. I think it's just like what's happening in my universe at the moment. You know, Promise was a dedication. It was actually... Yeah, it was a dedication. It was kind of I took our wedding vows and kind of mashed them up into a song form. So it was basically like, I said, can I see your wedding vows that we, you know, we had been married probably a year and a half by then. I was like, can I see your wedding vows? And,
oh my God, that's the most romantic thing I've ever
that's
heard.
Great. Well,
oh my God, my heart.
And so I looked at the wedding vows and I was like, oh, like just in like summary in a song form, these are our hopes. This is what we are saying to each other. And so that's like, so the female part is like, my wife's wedding vows is like, yo, this is terrifying and this is scary, but here I am. And mine was like, yo, I'll promise to be there for you. So it was great. I mean, it was like, it was really cool to have that as like one of the first songs I did, and people be like, that's a really good song. So I'm like, okay, I kind of have the chops. Again, it's like, it gave me that positive reinforcement to keep going.
Yeah, cool. So we're going to listen to the track Over and Over, the alternative version released March 2021.
If I'd ever known, I'd ever known how you'd forever change my life, I would up and go, I would up and go, I'd walk out of sight. But I'm glad I rearranged it, rearranged from falling apart. Cause you built me a mosaic, a perfect puzzle to capture my heart. So I promise I'll be there for you. I'll pick you up when you fall. You know I'll be here when you need me to. You need me to, so you won't have to stand alone.
Just the thought of you, of falling for you, my world turns upside down. Questions of how. Would you love me now, and could you hold me in the storm? Cause in my mind I would be crazy to let my heart lead this romance. But I promise every day
I'll be there for you. I'll pick you up when you fall. You know I'll be here when you need me to. You need me to, so you won't have to stand alone. So you won't have to stand alone. And so so I promise I'll be there for you. I'll pick you up when you fall. You know I'll be here when you need me to. You need me to, so you won't have to stand alone. So you won't have to stand alone. So you won't have to stand.
That was actually the first song I heard that you put out, and I was a fan. Like, your vocals are unique, incredible.
Thank you.
They stir you. They stir you. You're very, very good. Very impressed.
Thank you very much. It's taken me a while to get comfortable with my vocals, so I appreciate that.
I saw that. Is it because you didn't believe in yourself, or is it because you were focused on business? And like, to be in the London School of Economics, you must have been pretty scholarly.
I'm not overly bright. I mean, I guess I like stories, and I'm interested. I'm curious just about things, which is great to be in this audio industry, because it's like, I had to be curious to like teach myself. So I'm not overly bright, but I just was interested in the stories around the economics and the history. And like, and I, but my undergrad was in politics. So it's just, it's all about stories to me. Like, I loved the story. So I was curious. But to your first question, is like comfortable. I think there's a part of me that was, and is still like overly critical of what I do. Just that perfectionist, which is not a great, it's not a great thing to have as a creator or as a creative person, being like striving for perfection, because perfection never exists for the creative person, I don't think. And so when I heard myself sing, I was always like, that's a little flat, or ooh, that's a little weird. And so, and as a vocalist, or any, I think any vocal coach will tell you, is like all those fears and little negative thoughts, they actually constrict the muscles in your vocals and it makes it harder to sing. And it's just like this downward spiral. So it's been hearing myself sing like early on, it's just been this constant, like, I'm going to keep doing it and I'm going to keep getting better. And I'm going to I've done vocal lessons and vocal trainings to try to get better. And I've gotten to the point where I'm like, I know, like, there's going to be off days. I know I'm going to sound terrible. I'm going to hit a flat note and that's okay. And I know overall, it's like a muscle. If I keep training it, I'll get better. And so having feedback from people like you and having other people say like, your voice is amazing. I'm like, okay, so I should listen to them instead of like the demons on my shoulders saying like, as a flat note or it was a little scratchy or whatever that is. Right. So it's just been, a process and I'm still working on it. Right. It's a process.
Well, as a fellow creative, I find that actually very common in creatives,
yeah.
But I also find that the ones that are perfectionists and looking for more and more and more, put out the best music.
It might
not be perfect.
True. You're right.
But at least they're striving to be better than better than last release. But not really. I don't know if I'm communicating myself right, but it's like anything, even in sports, you don't win the Super Bowl and then say, okay, I'm done. So I can't do any better.
Right.
The next year, try to change the playbook to get there sooner, to get, it's probably not a good thing to sports and music, but in a sense of anybody that's going to be successful in life has to constantly refocus and look at what they're doing.
I totally agree.
Because you get stale.
Yeah, absolutely. And I look at like great artists that I admire, like Freddie Mercury or David Bowie or, these great artists, and they were constant. Like if I hear like behind the scenes interviews about their personalities and Prince, like they were these maniacal, like just driven people that you either shut up or get out of their way. Do you know what I mean? Like they were just these driven, perfect, like striving for perfection, which could have, I think there's a balance in that. I think sometimes it can really be detrimental to mental health to be so driven and so 100% perfectionist, but you hear it in their music. They're just constantly striving for that better than they were previous and pushing the boundaries. And it takes a lot of, it takes a lot. And I think you're right. There's that want to be better and that drive in the creative.
In anything. And I think, but creatives in particular, it's a trait. So David Bowie and Prince, are they artists that influenced your sound of music?
Not as much. I admire them as both of those as like amazing songwriters, and some of their songs I really jam on to. As far as like influencing, not as much as like I grew up on Led Zeppelin. Like my dad was a huge Zeppelin fan, and so that I've listened to like all the Led Zeppelin albums and back tracks and live recordings, and a lot of Jimmy Page's guitar work, especially around like the more folky songs like Brongniar. Going to California really taught me chops on acoustic guitar, like finger picking styles. And from there, I listened to their influences being very blues driven, like Robert Johnson, Blind Lemon, I think was one of just these Mississippi River Delta blues. And that sort of got me down this very acoustically driven storytelling role at an early age. I would say Led Zeppelin more so. But Freddie Mercury has always been like when I talk to a vocal coach and like, where do you want your vocals to sing? I was like, if I could get like a range like Freddie Mercury, I'd be happy. It's such a stretch, but, just as a performer, a songwriter, a producer, a musician, just all around like powerhouse of a creative person. Freddie Mercury, I think, is one of my top idols. Especially as, as I compare it to like the music industry of today, when there are, every pop song or top song has, three or four songwriters and several producers and engineers. And I look back at like these great, like David Bowie songs, Freddie Mercury songs. And it's like, who's the songwriter? It's Freddie Mercury. Who played the piano? It's Freddie Mercury. Maybe they had a producer on it, but it was like it was their song. Right. And so it's almost like it has more gravitas to see a single person writing this amazing song like Bohemian Rhapsody or, you know, Somebody to Love. And you're like, oh yeah, that was one dude who created this masterpiece versus like, you know, and I'm not to knock pop songs of today, but it is kind of like, oh, they had like a team of people and like a $200,000 budget to create this pop song. Yeah, of course it's going to be decent because you have a huge team. Yeah. Right.
Well, it's a different process, like anything
right.
else.
Right.
You know, and there's still artists that follow the old format, such as yourself.
Yeah. Well, I think most indie artists follow that format just for the necessity.
I would say that too.
Yeah.
More and more indie artists are writing and producing their own songs or writing their own songs, which didn't happen a long time ago, but it's becoming more. I've noticed that we're coming up to the next track, Everything I Am, which was inspired by the amazing event of becoming a new dad. And I noticed that quite a few of your songs are celebration of family celebration of maybe not community, but they're communal feeling. Mm-hmm. Was that because you had a nomadic upbringing?
That's a great question. That is a great question. Probably. I hadn't thought about that.
I read your bio.
Yeah. You've done your homework.
Yeah. And you moved around. Well, I wouldn't be here if I didn't.
That's right.
No, you moved around a lot. And then I noticed that a theme, like even in things that aren't talking about family and that, a theme. I was wondering if it was a way of healing your upbringing or coming together or sending a message. I just wanted your thoughts on it.
That's great. You know, I think you're absolutely right. I had not thought about it that way. It is my songwriting. There's always a tinge of melancholy or like this healing sort of sadness in a lot of the songs, right? I think it is like, I can remember moving a lot. It was super painful as an adolescent to be, you know, basically torn away from community and having to rebuild that, you know, several times over.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I think about the songwriting process, and it was like being a musician or being a guitar player at that time and writing just little songs, it was this, It soothed my nerves. It soothed my soul to just have, you know, that guitar was sometimes the only friend I had or the only person I knew was just these songs that were in my head and that I could play them to just self-soothe, right? And then as it started to record, these little tinges of sadness. And for me, I think through that process, I find beauty through the sadness is what I've told other musicians. Like, yeah. And even my daughter, like she listens to the new songs. She goes, "Dad is sad." I go, "Yeah, there's some sadness in there." But it's like it's like through those sad notes and through that loss that you can hear in my songs, I find the beauty on the other side. And so it's a very natural and a beautiful process to feel like the loss, to feel that sadness. Feel it through song, to hear it through voice, you know, put word to it. And then I come to the other side and it's like this beautiful, like fresh awakening, fresh morning, you know, feeling. A lot of my songs have that. I've told my wife too. I was like, I would love to write like an upbeat, like Justin Timberlake song, just to like dance to it. Or have my daughter be like, yeah, this is cool, like snappy track. And I've tried and it just doesn't work. So I don't know. I mean, I'll keep trying at it, but a lot of my songs do have that like melancholic feeling to it. I think you're absolutely right on that point too.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I'm seeing it from a creative perspective. I'm trying to figure out what brought out this amazing message that you give to fans. And
thank you.
That's what I see. Anyways, so we're going to listen to Everything I Am, also released March 2021.
Never felt time like I do now. I never wanted it so much to stay. I never knew love before you and now. I I'm trying to hold on in every way. So when I'm scared, you bring me courage. And this love is a terrifying thing. But when you call me, I'll answer. And if you need someone to hold your hand, when you're lonely, I'll be there. I will give you everything, everything I am. Well, it's your smile when we're dancing that brings me back to who I am. When I'm old, when I'm fading, these memories will bring me back, oh, bring me back. So when I'm scared, you bring me courage. And this love is a terrifying thing. But when you call me, I'll answer. If you need someone to hold your hand, when you're lonely, I'll be there. I will give you everything, everything I am. Oh. Someone to hold your hand. When you're lonely, I'll be there. I will give you everything that I am. That I am. That I am.
So how old is your daughter?
She is just shy of 3. So she's actually a couple weeks away from being 3 now. Almost like, oh, 10 days now. 10 days now.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So she's go ahead.
That's an angelic age.
It really is. It's really cool. Like she has the ability to communicate what she needs, but she still has these just like really funny ideas about, like, she'll put words together and I'm like, oh, I see. It's like, she would put like her story together in a way that I wouldn't think. I'm like, that's an interesting way to put your story. I see the words, and she's got this really funny personality, and she's powerful too, though. I mean, as a 3-year-old, she's got these, you know, these full grown adult emotions, but not the vocabulary and the tools to be able to deal with them or, you know, address them. So she's a very powerful being emotionally, and she's going to be a powerhouse.
Well, I'm sure she is. Yeah. You as a dad.
Yeah, my goodness.
Yeah.
But it's cool. It's cool to see them. I have another son too, and they're both pretty musical. Like I don't know if it's genetics or just because I'm around, but she sings along to my songs. I'm like, that's pretty cool. Like, she'll kind of hum the words. I'm like, yeah, I got a fan.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Great, yeah.
And does she know that this song that we just listened to, Everything I Am, was about her, about you becoming a dad to her?
I've told her. I don't know if she fully grasps like the concept of what that means. I think I think to her, all of my songs are hers. Like she's like this, like she'll say my song. I go, okay, it's your song, whatever you want. So I think to her, it's like these songs and the radio are playing just for her. So I've told her, but I think it'll take maybe a couple more years for her to fully conceptualize like, oh, I get it. He's like writing a message to like me and this is what it's about. But yeah, she's great with my music.
That's awesome. I have children too, and it's awesome when they show traits and interests and things that make your part of your life, a huge part of your life, right. The creative part. That's insane.
Great. It's really fun.
So the next topic we're going to speak about is prayer. Which is your wish for a better world. And it's part of the new album. And tell you the truth, I love the name of the album.
Oh, thank you.
Honestly, with the tracks that you selected for this, it's the perfect title for that EP.
Thank you.
It's amazing.
Thank
you. So tell us a bit more about prayer.
So prayer, it was... I tell my fans, and I think that single just came out actually yesterday, March 10. I tell my fans, and I wrote about it, it's a song that's just for me. And it was scary to put it out there. And what I mean by just for me is like I woke up with this melody in my head and this feeling of, and a lot of my songs lately have been this feeling of like I'm almost creating songs as like memory placeholders in my life, so that because I have this unjustified fear that as I get older I'm gonna forget like what it was for my kids to be 1 and 3, or you know, what my life was before kids. So I'm almost like subconsciously creating these songs about my life as like memory placeholders, so that when I'm 90 I can listen back to like my songs and be like, oh yeah, I remember that now. That was the feeling I had. So prayer came out was like I had this melody and I woke up and I was just feeling the weight of like I was looking at some photos of my daughter as she was like a year old and then she was like 2, and I'm like, man, like the change is exponential. Like as a parent, you know, it's the time totally flies. The nights are long, but the years are super short.
Oh, it's huge.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't think non-parents can really get it. I can say it, but I heard it when I was becoming a parent, but I really experienced it. So I had this feeling of like, time is just really slipping by. So this song was, I woke up, I was probably like 4 a.m. I just put a mic in front of my piano and started playing the melody. And the song was for me because it was a really... I didn't put a lot of thought into popular chord structure or chord or song progression. I didn't edit the lyrics very much at all. It was just this stream of thought, like, let me remember these moments. Let me live this day. Let me not take on the burdens of every day and let them overwhelm me. You know, let me basically be in the moment with my daughter when I can. Just this prayer to like whomever is listening, just let me live life to the fullest now, so that when I'm 60 or 70, I'm not gonna look back and go, wow, I spent way too much time like in the studio or at work. So let me remember these moments with her, so that when I'm dying, when I'm at my end of my years, I can look back and go, that was a good life. Because it was just this feeling of like life is passing and I wanna capture it as much as I can. I wanna be there as much as I can. So that's what prayer is about. And I tell my fans, it's a song for me. The scary part of putting a song like that out there is like, it's definitely not going to make the algorithm of Spotify. Cause there's no popular song structure, but I think it's still beautiful enough to put out there to let people say like, hey, this is what's happening in my universe. It was almost like if I was more commercially minded, I probably just would have kept it in my back pocket and been like, I'm listening to this every once in a while and it's going to be for me. But instead I was like, you know what? I'm going to put this out there as like an unveiling of like, this is what's going on inside my head as a musician, as a songwriter, strictly just for me. So that's prayer.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we're going to listen to Prayer, part of Colby's new album that was released March of 2021. Thank you.
Please help me live this day. Bring peace and joy, let these memories stay. And this I know, to love her always.
One thing I want to talk to you about, and I thought you might be able to offer sort of advice or a roadmap for other indie artists. Your music, and in particular your music with Nate Donis of Fordella's Machine, earned various TV and film placements with MTV's Degrassi High, 90210, Heart Signal, Barely Breathing, and independent films. How did you go about doing that? Like, if an indie artist was interested in submitting their music, is there a certain submission process you use? Do you go through an agent?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's a mixed question. I mean, it's a mixed answer on my end. So I'll put it in the most succinct forms I can. And I think it's a great question because, you know, for musicians who have been in the music industry as long as I have, it's almost like we can see three basic forms of streams of revenue, right? Touring, which is like touring shows and merch sales. I'll include that in touring. Streaming revenue, which is, unless you're making millions of streams, it's like almost negligible. And then TV and ad and film placements. And that latter is really, well, at least for me, it's like it can generate a lot of passive income. It can be really, it can really support your artistry if you get the right connections and right ins and outs of it. You know, when we started out, it was still like kind of bleeding over from the older model, where and this model still exists today, but there's more options today. But it was like you had to have an agent who knew somebody who had the connections to placements. So when we first started out, we started out with a great agent who I'm still in contact with and I still work with, Elise Schiller. She was out of Angry Mob, out of LA, and she took a liking to our music. And for that model, the sync agency sort of music supervision model, you really just have to find one person who's a champion of your music, who has connections. And that's what we had, fortunately. And it's just that it's really that connection game. And so that landed those first, you know, 90210, Degrassi High placements. And that was just, it was so cool. I think the first time I heard my music placed in another television show, I audibly gasped and I was like, oh my God, like that's so, it was so cool. It was the coolest feeling. And I think I was just like watching the show and I knew it was in the episode, but I wasn't like planning on it. It came on. I was like, oh my God, like that's the song that I wrote. And it was just this cool feeling, I think, because it was this other form of validation of like this other creative in this completely different industry of TV and film was like, this song adds value to this scene. It was like this creative approval, if that makes sense. It was another artist in a different field being like, yeah, your song has extra value and it's add value to my product or my project. So that was very cool. So we got those two first big placements and we still plug away at that area. I think some of the other placements that we've had, a lot of the placements, the majority of actually placements from my specific album came out of what I'll call like micro licensing platforms. These are platforms like SongTrader, Artlist, Marmoset, MusicFine, AudioSocket. They're more library oriented. They're more the user has to look for the music, you know, via genre or via mood.
Oh, okay. I know that. I have a few friends that have.
Yeah. And it mostly, it was a conscious decision to realize that, you know, those big, that model of like music supervision, music publisher, sync agent, that's where the big fish are. Like if I'm going whale hunting, that's what I want. Like you'll get the Paramount, the 20th Century Fox, the ABC, the big placement in the title credits of a show or the ending film credits. And that's big money. That's 5-6 figures. And that's awesome. But catching that whale you may never catch that whale and you might go forever without ever seeing that placement. But if you do, that's awesome. So our music was in that model was not doing that great, you know, and I think agents have limited time and they want to, whatever's fresh, they'll go, oh, this is fresh music, I'm gonna put it out. So if you're not constantly producing music, that's, you're kind of on the back burner if you're with an agency or a publisher, unless you're like super big. So the conscious decision on my part was to say, okay, I can license one song for 20 grand for a show, or, you know, 10 grand for one show or film, or I can license at $10 a pop, 10,000 licenses, right? For from indie filmmaker or YouTube creator or wedding videographer or some abstract TV show. Yeah, you can buy and license my song for 10 bucks. And if I get 10,000 of those, well, that adds up a hell of a lot more than the one, you know, $5,000 placement or $10,000 placement that I got. And so that was a strategic move. And I think with a lot of artists, and I think it did two things. It's generated a lot of income for me to go, okay, now I can actually justify without going to my wife and be like, can I spend $3,000 on this mic? Or can I hire this PR person for $5,000? It justified like, okay, I got revenue coming in. This is a business now. I've got actual revenue stream and I can hire this producer or hire this studio. So that did one thing. The second thing that really helped was with the amazing marketing, because these content producers and creators, they're all over the place. They're doing, like I said, lots of YouTube, Instagram videos, wedding videographers. They're doing independent films. They're doing independent TV shows. They don't have a lot of budget, but they got a big fan base. And so once we placed Riddell's Machine and my first EP in that micro-licensing platforms, it just like blew up. People have, every week we probably get like five or 10 new super fans just being like, I love your music. I've never heard of you. Where have you been? I heard your song on this little baking tutorial or on this, like someone's wedding video. I heard your song on this little TV show. And it's just been this amazing marketing tool. So there's some other nuances to it, but I think to singer songwriters is like, if you're trying to make a revenue and you're not getting the revenue you need from streaming or touring and merch sales, like try the micro licensing. There are some downsides to it and we can get into that, but it's a great marketing tool and it's a great revenue stream. It really helped me and saved my music career from like just being like, all right, forget it. It's too much time and not enough money, recuperation on my end. So it's a great, those great platforms, those micro licensing platforms are great.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for that thoughtful and detailed explanation. That's amazing. I'm glad that there's things out there like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
They can go two routes. Mm-hmm. So one question I do have, and it might be technical.
Yeah.
If you have it registered on the micro platforms, can you then still present it to the other route, to TV shows?
I think that's a great question. You're very insightful, Shay. It's a great question. And that's kind of there's a little bit of a trade-off in that. So the short answer is yes, you can. you can completely license and go the other route. And I do that still. I still work with a sync agent, and I'm still pitching to bigger music publishing houses and bigger projects. What I hear, I haven't talked to a music supervisor or a publisher on the big end intimately, but from what I hear is that if you have too much of your catalog or 100% of your catalog in these micro licensing sites, they kind of see it as like, well, it's kind of everywhere. It's kind of diluted in its licensing ability. Now I could be totally wrong in that, but that's at least what I'm hearing through the grapevine. And not to say that's a bad thing. You can make some good strategic plays. So you definitely can. I think some music supervisors want that exclusivity, or they want that ability to be that first, to be the music supervisor to say, I first broke this person or broke this artist on this show, and to have that like somewhat sense of ownership. But it can work really well. So there's a little bit of trade-off in that. And what I've done specifically, and this might help other indie artists, is, you know, take one aspect of your catalog or take one album that you're releasing and put it in all these microsites, put it non-exclusively in all these microsites, SongTrader, Music, Vine, Marmoset, put it out there as much as you can to create a massive foundation of marketing and potential revenue. And then once you've got that notoriety and you've got that PR and that people wanting your music, go, okay, now this next album, I'm going to wait for the bigger publisher to come along, or maybe I'll have some things that are exclusive and some things that are not exclusive. So there's that's the strategy that I'm employing. I'll let you know in a couple of years if it worked, but there's some forethought into that of, you know, creating, using some music as absolute just marketing, just giving it away for free and letting people use it as much as they want, and then having some stuff in your back pocket. So those are my thoughts on it. But that's a great question. It's a great question.
Okay, great. Thank you again. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. So the next song we're going to listen to is Grace. It's about a dark subject, but could I term it uplifting at the same time?
I think, yeah, absolutely. I think it's dark.
Okay,
all right. You could term it like inspiring, uplifting, yeah.
Well, you told me it was about a young girl who committed suicide, yeah. So that's what I mean by dark. But I also see it as uplifting, yeah. Hearing it. Tell me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's meant to be that net to catch someone. It was inspired by, I think, a dark event, but it's meant to be that, you know, that capture. As you mentioned, it was, there was a young gal in my, community. I didn't know her specifically. I heard it was through like a school, you know, one of my neighbors had a friend who had went to the school, and they told a story, and she was like 13, 14, committed suicide. And I thought, when I heard that, having a daughter, I thought how hard and painful must life be for someone who's 13, you know, in, from my perspective, like your life is barely getting started. Like how hard must life be to have that person say, I'm done. Like I can't do with this anymore. And I thought that it crushed me because I have a daughter, and I was like, God, I can't even imagine the parents and the people, and I can't imagine. So I as a songwriter, I have this idea that, you know, I have this gift, I have this talent, I have the know-how. So I should use this gift to, in times, put out a message, put out something that will make the world a better place, even if it is just like a personal message or whatever. But this was, I think, one of the songs. I don't have a lot of songs like this, but this was an intentional, like, hey, if you're in this place, may you find a song that eases your pain. May there be a friend there to help you through your troubled days. Like whatever, all those lyrics is may you just have the grace to face one more day. Because if I can't, I don't know who you are. I probably can't be there for you physically, but my music can maybe transform your emotions and maybe give you some upliftment. So the song it's meant to soothe. It's meant to be the soothing, like just calming. It's meant to do that. It's meant to heal a broken heart or a crushed soul. So it's definitely in that genre of, it's from dark, but it's meant to uplift.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's beautiful. So we're going to listen to Grace up next.
May you find a song that eases all your pain. May there be a friend to help you through your troubled days. May you realize the world conspires to love you in every way. And may you find grace. Now who may these words be the first to mend a broken heart, to help you see the ending is also the start. May there be a light when shadows come creeping in the dark. May you find grace. May you find grace. And when the world turns cruel and cold, and when days turn to nights, what's a never ending, and you feel all alone, may you find a song that eases all your pain. May there be a friend to help you through your troubled days. May you realize the world conspires to love you in every way. May you find grace. Find grace. Oh, may you find grace. May you find grace.
So that was an interesting and beautiful tribute to a girl that ended her life so soon and tragically. Can you tell us a bit more about the other tracks on the album? Anything you want to talk about the process?
The other song on the EP is Over and Over. The original mix is what you've heard. Oh, you didn't hear that. You heard the alternate mix, but the other song is Over and Over. It's great choir song sound in it.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, that was really challenging recording. I didn't know where it was going because it was like, I think 15 different vocals, three or four part harmony in places. And it just really came together. I was like, that's a great sound. So I was really pleased with it.
I want you to talk a bit more, but you did 15 separate vocal parts to create the gospel choir.
Yeah. I would have.
That's amazing.
Thank you. I would have hired a gospel choir had I the budget or the connections. But so being an independent musician, I was like, I'll just redo it. But it like, I did research on like gospel choir arrangements and how like, what, like, was it the 1-3 and the 5? Or I think it's actually just the 1-3 and the 1 on gospel choirs. But yeah, it was like, so many hours in just my little vocal booth being like, okay, do this one line. And I doubled and tripled each line to have like that choir effect, right? So you have like one part, one harmony sung like three times, and then like the other part harmony sung like three times. And that's where that 15-part vocal choir comes in. And it took a lot, and it took a lot of hours, but it was really cool. I loved the feeling. I probably wouldn't do it again because it was so taxing and took such a long time, but I enjoy the end product of it. And it's really, really fun to listen to. And yeah, as far as future projects, I told myself I would wait like a good while after this EP drop before I started creating new stuff. But I keep finding myself writing down little lyrics and playing around with little, melodic arrangements on my guitar. And so I can't stop the process. But I've got a few songs in the works, and my next plan is to release a fuller album with a producer and going into the studio and having a team. Like I mentioned before, this next one is definitely going to be a team because it's just more fun, and I'm going to have some more fun with music. And yeah, for new fans, you can find me on Spotify, anywhere you listen to music, Apple iTunes, Apple Music, Spotify, Tidal. Follow me on Instagram. That's where I'm most active and posting like behind the scenes recording processes,
ultimate. Yeah, I see that.
Yeah, just do like little things that tickle me, tickle my fancy. It's like I'll put up like a strictly just, violin mix, so I can say like, here's the string parts that I'm working with, or here's the vocal part broken down, and here's my new piece of gear, and I'm in the studio recording today. So Instagram is the best place to find me. But yeah, that's what it is for me. I have the luxury of being an independent artist who doesn't have to rely on my music for income. So I have this, like I said, it's just a luxury to be able to write and record whenever I want. But there's always new music coming out, and so stay tuned for more stuff. And with this specific release of those alternate mixes, remixed songs by different producers, that'll be coming out shortly. I mean, probably July, September. I haven't set a date yet, but those will be coming out later this year.
Well, your music is outstanding.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to quote Jason Griscoff of IndianShuffle.com because he said what I want to say. Good Lord, it had me hooked from the word go.
Thank you.
Like the minute I heard your talk, and I was just fooling around on Facebook.
Oh, thank you so much.
Right? And I was like, wow.
Thank you.
Remember sending your message, went, oh my God, I got to get you on my show.
I'm so glad you reached out, and it's amazing that my music found you, and thank you so much for the kind words and for your time today. I really appreciate it, and for what you do, for giving a platform to indie artists. I think it's important work, so thank you for doing what you do.
Yeah, it's important for indie because indie music is important, and I appreciate your kind words. So keep putting out that great music. I'm going to be following you, and I'm sure after this show you're going to have a slew of new fans. And thank you, and have a great night this evening. Thanks for joining
me. Thank you as well. Thank you, Shay.
Bye. Well, thank y'all for tuning in. Next episode, Terry and 3TL from Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario, Canada, joins us. His music is up for 7 nominations at the Red Carpet Awards show in Holland, taking place in the spring of this year. Among the nominations are Song of the Year for Country and Songwriter Entertainer. So catch you at the pod next episode on Air Indie, from my pad to yours over the airways. Subscribe feeds at thebuzzerpod.com. Cheers.